Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
I think we are all kind of hitchhikers in our life. We look for evidence whether God exists or whether he doesn't exist, and different people come to different conclusions. So it's one of the most interesting questions, I would say, that is around in the universe and in my personal life as well. And as a scientist, I want to look now at some scientific evidence and evaluate it, whether it is a good argument for the existence of God or for some other worldview. I have encountered quite a few people who in the church sometimes feel like this when they hear the word science. At the same time, during my PhD, I have encountered some PhD students who feel the same when they hear the word church. So I would say that's not necessary. And my recommendation for all of them is don't panic. Just meet and talk to each other. There is broad room for conversation. In The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, actually, there is a very interesting quote. It's not a neutral book, but it takes a position on our question. And this quote by Douglas Adams, the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, is also quoted in The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins. And it goes like this. Isn't it enough to see that a garden is beautiful without having to believe that there are fairies at the bottom of it too? So the alternative that is given here is either there are fairies in the garden which are responsible for the beauty of the garden, or there are no fairies in the garden. So the garden is just beautiful by itself. But of course, this is a false alternative because it only deals with purely immanent factors, fairies or no fairies. But of course, fairies are not necessary for a beautiful garden. The important thing is that we recognize a garden because there is a gardener who is not part of the garden, who is, so to say, transcendent to the garden. And I mean, this is already a very important point that can be seen in the first on the first page of Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. Just four different models. I love set theory, by the way. So this is a small introduction into set theory. How do science and faith relate to each other? I would say there are four main models for this. One model is the non-overlapping magisteria model by Stephen Jay Gould, which says science has one domain and faith has another domain. But the two domains do not overlap. They are just separate. They can't talk to each other. The second model would be the overlapping magisteria model, which would say that, yeah, there are some areas where they are not connected, but there is some overlap. There are some questions that can be relevant to science and faith at the same time. There's a third model, which would say there is no science without faith. You always need faith in order to do science. And of course, faith is also a term that would have to be determined first in order to justify this model. And then there's a fourth model, which would say that science will determine and explain everything about faith. So faith is just a subdiscipline of science, like Frank Tipler, who wrote a book, The Physics of Infinity or of Eternity. I don't know how it's called in English. And he says that theology is just a subdiscipline of science. Let's look at some citations of scientists, how they view the evidence. For example, Peter Atkins from Oxford. He says, humanity should accept that science has eliminated the justification for believing in cosmic purpose, and that any survival of purpose is inspired solely by sentiment. Or which seems to indicate there is no purpose, and therefore there is no purpose giver. It's just the cosmos, it's just matter. Carl Sagan says, the cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. So there is no place for anything spiritual or from for any spiritual beings. Richard Lewontin says it in a very interesting way. It is not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. So he's very honest. He admits it's not that we can conclude from science that there is no God, but he says we need to presuppose that there is no God. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. So there is no science if we allow God. That's his opinion, obviously. But I think it's a different argument than the argument from the two scientists before. Let's listen to Einstein. Einstein said, "I believe in Spinoza's God, who reveals himself in the orderly harmony of what exists, not a God who concerns himself with the fates and actions of human beings." So Einstein has a lot of quotations that he believes there is a God, but for him it's not a personal God, it's rather a world principle, something pantheistic, keeping everything together and holding up the harmony in the universe. Sir John Newton, another scientist, "Size and energy and precision, such is the wonder and magnificence of the universe God has created. Where do these laws of nature come from? They are not invented by human brains. Rather, they are discovered because they too are part of God's creation. They are God's laws. The science humans explore is God's science." So he obviously thinks that the laws that we discover indicate that there is a God, and that these laws and the size and the energy and the precision in the universe are indications that there is a God. Or very poignant, Sir Gillian Prance frames it. He says, "All my studies in science," he's a botanist, "have confirmed my faith. I regard the Bible as my principal source of authority." So he doesn't see a conflict between believing in the Bible as the word of God and at the same time being an active scientist and a renowned scientist. Luba has performed a survey among 1,000 randomly chosen U.S. scientists. And the question was, "Do you believe in a personal God who answers prayers and in personal immortality?" So the existence of an immortal soul. In 1916, 40% of the scientists answered, "Yes, we do believe that." 60% said no. The study was performed again 80 years later. And people expected that the numbers for yes would drop significantly. But actually, the difference is just 2%. Still, 38% of the scientists said, "Yes, I do believe in a personal God who answers prayers." So this was a surprise. And it would be interesting to repeat this survey again in this year. But it just shows you there are scientists who believe in a God, and there are scientists who don't believe in a God and have different views. So the conflict, obviously, is not between faith in God and science, like it is often claimed because of the Galileo-Galilei affair, who had to refuse his own findings due to the pressure of the Inquisition. But it's much more a conflict between two worldviews. And also the Galileo affair can be explained in different ways. The two worldviews. This is Mother Nature. And of course, different people coming from different backgrounds will see different mothers here. Some will see a very old mother, maybe even a grandmother. Others will see a young mother, maybe just having given birth to a child. And it really depends from where you come. Either you come from the left side or from the right side. And this shows we always come from a worldview that we bring with us. And our perception is shaped by that worldview, and it is usually self-reinforcing. It takes serious counter-arguments to change my worldview. Bumps are often smoothed, like in the middle picture. You have some questions from both worldviews that it doesn't really fit your own picture. And so sometimes communication between different worldviews might be difficult, because for some it's the nose, for others it's just a pickle within in the face. Every worldview consists of a set of basic assumptions about the fundamental structure of reality, questions of the origin, the destiny, what can we hope, of the meaning of our life, of what should I do, moral, and what can I do, knowledge. I don't want to expand on that too long. And with regard to our subject, I think we have three categories of worldviews. And we can find out these categories by two questions. We can first ask the question, is the cosmos real? And if the answer is no, it's just an illusion, an emanation of something different, then we usually end up in pantheism or idealism. The real thing are the ideals, like with Plato, or the real theistic godhead that is behind all the universe and that emanates. If the answer is yes, the cosmos is real, then we can ask a second question. Is the cosmos all there is? Or is there anything else? If the answer is yes, the cosmos is all, as Carl Sagan would say, then we end up in atheism or materialism. Then there is nothing but the cosmos. If we say no, then there is something transcendent beyond the cosmos that can look at the cosmos, but is not the cosmos itself or themselves. And so we end up in theism, usually, which is God and his creation. So these three are the main worldviews with which we have to deal when we ask scientific evidence for the existence of God. And the big question is not which of these worldviews can be proven to be true, because science can't prove that. But the big question is, if we look at the scientific evidence, to which of these worldviews does it fit best? How can it be reconciled with these different worldviews? And of course, you can always find arguments to reconcile it, but it's worth to ask the plausibility question, but it also depends on your background, where you come from, as I have indicated already. Test questions for worldviews are consistency test. Is my worldview logically consistent in itself? Then the test of correspondence, with which we have to deal today. Does the perceived reality, for example, the scientifically perceived reality, does it match my worldview, or are there contradictions? And then there is the test of practicability. Can I live what I believe in my practical, in my daily life? We will deal with the second question most of the time. So if we look at materialism, then there are two possibilities. Causation takes only place by matter and by its structure. So the structure also contains the interactions between matter. So it's by laws, like Newton's laws of motion, for example, and by contingency, by chance, with regard to it, to the initial conditions of a system. For example, how did the universe begin? What is the initial state of the universe? And this usually can't be deduced by law, but just can be extrapolated from our present state. But we don't know why the initial conditions in the early universe were just as they were. Actually, they were quite improbable. It's a state of very low entropy, as we know today, which is rather puzzling, because it would be more probable that entropy would have been much larger at the beginning of the universe. But that's another question, just for the experts of you. I don't know how many physicists are among you. So what that means is that matter is primary and spirit is secondary, bottom up. Second, pantheism. Pantheism works basically very much like materialism, apart from one additional factor. There is a directing force behind all that. So law and to some degree contingency can play a role, but all this is guided by hidden principles, or by one hidden principle that actually controls the history of the universe to reach a certain goal at some point. So also here, matter actually is what happens, and spirit, our consciousness and so on, all this is only secondary. But it might have been in the mind of the universe, so to say, even though usually it's not a real mind, but it's just a certain structure that forces the universe to develop in a certain way. causing harmony, for example, causing evolution to go up and up the ladder, so to say. And then third, there is theism, and causation within theism means it's always God's active working, which can happen in different categories. It can happen in his sustaining action of the natural order, the so-called natural laws. Seasons, water cycle, and all this is already even mentioned in part of the Bible. And then there is his intended direction of the natural order. For example, if you look at Israel's exodus through the Red Sea, then you can read that a strong east wind started to blow and the sea went back and there was dry land. So somehow it seems there is a natural explanation for that. But still we might ask, why did it happen at that place and at that time, just at the right place at the right time for Israel to pass through the Red Sea, and at the wrong time and wrong place for the Egyptians to pass through as well? And then third, there is his direct supernatural intervention, a miraculous intervention, so to say. For example, the resurrection of Jesus, it will be very hard to use quantum mechanics and general relativity to explain the resurrection of Jesus. This can only be explained by a supernatural intervention. So here, spirit is primary and matter is secondary only. So this is the arena. These are the combatants in the arena who all have to deal with the scientific enterprise. I want to mention two shortcuts before we start our hitchhiking through the universe, which will start in 5 minutes. So shortcut one. Often you can hear the argument, we don't know any mechanism, hence it was God, like in this comic. Yeah, I think you should be more explicit here in step two. There, then a miracle occurs between the two equations. Of course, this is not the right way how to implement God in scientific research. As soon as there is a mechanism, God is gone. And a lot of people think it is just like that. If we discover something, God is gone, and God becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. At the same time, we must be careful if we discover that there is a gap in our understanding. We cannot just say by default, hence it emerged, and evolution is true anyway. But a gap is a gap, and a gap might be a big gap that cannot be bridged by natural mechanisms. If we start from a neutral position between the worldviews, at the same time, it's not at once evidence for God's acting, for God's supernatural acting. So we just have gaps in our understanding, and it's not an argument for one or the other. But some gaps tend to be more larger gaps when our knowledge increases, and other gaps tend to close. So there might be different gaps within scientific research. Shortcut number two, it's just the opposite. We know the mechanism, hence there is no God. Imagine that I come with my German Volkswagen, which is very environmentally friendly, of course, as we all know from the news. And then the Aborigines look at this Volkswagen and they say, wow, this is just an amazing God that is in this material box and moving that. So it must be something godly. And then I get out of my car and open the motor cover and I explain how the motor works. But of course, this does not disprove that there is an author and a creator to this car, and even a sustainer to this car, which has to be checked every 2 months. So a discovered mechanism is not a counter argument against the existence of an author. Very important. Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, said it like this: the whole modern conception of the world is founded on the illusion that the so-called laws of nature are the explanations of natural phenomena. So a law is not the final explanation of what is there. It's just a description. The explanation is still on other grounds. And one example of this argument is like this. We know that everything has evolved, so evolution explains the history of the universe, a mechanism, and hence we know there is no God. Materialism is the right worldview. Of course, this is not true, because a mechanism doesn't disprove that there could be an author that has implemented the mechanism in a very intelligent way, for example. So it's just the other way around. If materialism is my worldview, then I only have one possibility. The world must have evolved from simple starting points to more complex points if I start with pure matter. What else should the history of the universe look like then? And you can see that with ancient philosophers like Epicurus and Lucretius, who have already thought about this, or Democritus and Leucippus. So materialism implies evolution, while theism does not imply evolution. It could be different, but it could also be evolution, just on philosophical grounds. But therefore, if evolution could be proven to be wrong, then we would know that materialism is wrong, because it has a problem. There is no alternative. Of course, it's a hot discussion whether evolution can be proven to be wrong at all, because it's a historical question and you only have plausibility arguments and can change your conception of history always. So it's a question that I want to leave to another debate. Yeah, don't panic. Now, this was a long introduction, but I think a necessary introduction to all the worldview issues behind all that, in order to avoid shortcuts and misunderstandings. So let's get on board, my hitchhiker friends. Let's start with the philosophy of science, then move on to cosmology, and then to biology, and then draw conclusions. Get on board our spaceship. So philosophy of science, when we land on this planet, one thing we find there is it teaches that there are limits to science. Science, the scientific method, must be reproducible. So singular events are not really accessible to the method of science, only by indirect means. Then falsifiability is an important criterion. And scientific theories are always must be falsifiable, which means that they cannot be proven to be true 100%, because there must be a test that they can be false. Like I could say, cats eat fish. This is my scientific theory. And it proves true all the time, until I hit that water pool, that water basin at the top right corner, and I see in this case, it obviously has been the other way around, that the fish actually has killed the cat and eaten it. So my theory was falsifiable, and it seemed to be right all the time until I hit that water basin. Then Kurt Gödel, a mathematician, has proven that scientific theories and mathematical theories are always incomplete. You can never prove that they are consistent within themselves. You always need certain axioms that can't be proven within the system itself. So there is a certain incompleteness, a logical incompleteness that is inherent to all explanations in the scientific method. There are social limits, there are physical limits like Heisenberg's uncertainty, the speed of light with which information can travel at maximum speed, and there is chaos theory. I don't want to go into the details, but just I want to note there are limits to science, and scientific theory is always preliminary. It never arrives at the final stage, at the ultimate truth. It's a hitchhiking through the universe. Arthur Eddington said in a famous parable, The Fisherman's Net, that actually scientists can only catch those things in reality which fit into the net. So it can catch atoms, it can catch forces and so on, but what it can't catch is beauty, the question of ultimate origin, where we come from, the question of meaning, of moral, what we should do, even the question of what we can know can't be answered by science, and the question of destiny, and of course, the question of God, which is also related to all these questions somehow. So science, the scientific method, cannot be applied to the question of God, for example, at least not in the way to prove the existence of God. Of course, if you look at nature and think that nature is God's work, then you can find traces of the super intelligent being that has left its traces in nature, but you can't prove God's character and God's person by that. You can only say it's plausible that there is a superintelligent being, and we will come to that later. So Gödel's theorems seem to indicate that belief needs to be prior to knowledge. You need to believe to base your research on something before you can know anything at all. So in philosophy, there is a famous definition of knowledge, and that is called justified true belief, which means knowledge can only be known if you believe it and if you have some justification for your belief. So it's more than just a belief, it's a justified belief. And of course, it must correspond with reality, which is not always easy to decide. For example, when we come to the question of the existence of God. So Gödel obviously is in favor of the model that belief is foundational, and science is a special case of belief if there are additional criteria met. Of course, this is not the Christian belief necessarily. It is just a certain belief from which knowledge is derived. But I can't go into the details. But it's very interesting that scientists have come to a very interesting observation. Eugene Wigner, Nobel Prize winner, wrote an article, The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Natural Sciences. Today, we take it for granted that nature can be described by mathematical equations. But this can't be taken for granted, actually. Why can we describe nature with mathematics with such astonishing accuracy and predict the future? He really struggled about that and puzzled about that. It's like having always the right key for the next door, even though the door could just be locked and you have no key for that. But mathematics seems to be the right key for the basic structure of physical reality. And he says, the miracle of the appropriateness of the language of mathematics for the formulation of the laws of physics is a wonderful gift which we neither understand nor deserve. He's an agnostic, by the way, so he doesn't take a position in favor of God, but he's also very critical about the pre-assumptions that scientists take for granted. And Albert Einstein said it in a similar way. He said, the most incomprehensible thing about the world is that it is at all comprehensible. We could also ask, why did modern science emerge and succeed in Christian Europe, which in medieval times was not the hub of the universe, but rather an underdeveloped area in the world. But it was exactly in this area of the world, and not in China, not in Arabia, even though they contributed to that and Europeans took knowledge from them, technical knowledge and also the ancient Greek philosophers and so on, and developed from that the methodological, the scientific method. And Whitehead's thesis, Whitehead is a philosopher of the last century, he says that the reason for this is that Christians and Jewish believers believe that there is a rational lawgiver, and hence they expect a rational law in nature. And this is something that is different, for example, from Chinese philosophy. One example, Johannes Kepler, what did he say? He said, the most important goal of all examinations about the external world should be to discover the rational order which has been imposed on it by God and which he has revealed to us in mathematics. Mathematics is the language of God. And doing science means thinking God's thoughts after him, thinking like God, so to say. And other famous people who did science agree with Johannes Kepler. Until today, even some Nobel Prize winners like Arbor or Francis Collins, no, Francis Collins has not yet won the Nobel Prize, but he organized the Human Genome Project. But famous scientists who were excellent scientists and are excellent scientists agree with Johannes Kepler. So the big question is the comprehensibility of nature by mathematical methods and by logical methods. For which, to which of these worldviews does this fit best? And I would say if you have if you observe a congruence, a working together and a fitting together of independent systems like material nature, matter, of abstract logic, which has nothing to do with nature at all, and with biological organisms who are called human beings and are able to think in their material structure and can understand both abstract logic and can observe nature and control it, predict its future, I would say this congruence of these three independent systems argues for some kind of intentionality. Let me explain. There is a big problem for materialism. If our thoughts are the results of the neurons in our brain and nothing else, then why should they be true, these thoughts? They are just caused by natural forces and by contingent initial conditions. Of course, evolutionary, you could argue, well, they are true because they increase our fitness. But then this is not an argument for truth. It's just an argument for increasing our fitness. So finally, if a materialist is a scientist, he cuts off his own branch on which he is sitting or she is sitting, because then reason is nothing else but just a variant of non-reason. Then non-reason is the ultimate reality, but we trust that our reason obviously is able to discover truth, and I trust it, otherwise I would not speak to you in this webinar now if we can't interact in order to find out truth. On the other hand, in Christian theism, people believe that there is the truth in three books. And this is very nicely reflected, beautifully reflected in the Harvard Harvard sign, which says Veritas, truth in Latin. And there come together three books. One book is God's word that he spoke personally, how he revealed himself in Jesus and in the Old Testament prophets, and then in God's works in nature, and then God's thoughts that have been implemented in God's works. So these three books come together, and we need to tackle all three to come to grips with truth. So within a Christian framework, it is not surprising that God, who commands us to analyze his works and nature, has given us the mind to do this as well, and that his abstract ideal language of mathematics fits within our thoughts and with nature. So we could expect this. In materialism, this is not easy. Of course, in pantheism, you could argue different ways, because there is no personal God, but you could say there is a principle that wanted from the beginning that there must be beings that lead to the self-consciousness of the universe itself. But still, this is very speculative. So let's move on to the next planet, hitchhikers, the universe. Let's move into cosmology. Einstein's theory of relativity enables us to extrapolate the history of the universe into the past. Of course, there are several assumptions with all that and so on. I can't go into the details in this short seminar. But we come to the conclusion that there was a beginning, which was not always held by scientists until the 30s of the 20th century. In the 1930s, they started to be persuaded that there must be a beginning to the universe. Before that, that was very controversial. And even in the 80s, there were still articles against the beginning of the universe, because people suspect that this is too much a theistic worldview if there is a beginning to the cosmos. So Arno Penzias, who discovered one of the big milestones, one of the big evidence pieces for the beginning, the cosmic microwave background, he said in the New York Times, the best data we have are exactly what I would have expected had I nothing to go on but the first five books of the Bible, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. The Torah, should it read. The first five books of the Bible is the Torah. Yeah. So he says there is no contradiction. He's actually a Jew, but his quote is right anyway. So the argument that could be made from that is, first, everything that begins to exist has a cause. And I would even add to that a non-intrinsic cause. Otherwise, it would come to existence by itself without having existed before. Second, the universe begins to exist. Cosmologists, most of them, are very much of this opinion. And then the conclusion is the universe has a non-intrinsic cause. So the question is, what kind of cause is this? The universe consists of matter, and matter itself exists in time and space. Time and space, space-time, are intricately connected to matter. So the cause, if it's beyond it, if it's not intrinsic, should be timeless, spaceless, and immaterial, but still effective, being able to work on matter. What categories of entities are there that could be causes? There could be matter, but of course, matter comes into existence at the beginning of the universe. So that would mean that the universe actually had no beginning, but it existed forever. It just went through different phases. So this is not a good candidate because matter is part of the universe. Then there are abstracta, ideas, numbers, principles, structures, like the Platonic ideal bodies, for example. But they actually are just mind objects. And it is difficult to see how these should be effective in shaping matter or creating anything. A number does not create anything. So a third category, of course, would be persons, personal beings. Personal beings have a spiritual side to them and a material side, or at least they can interact. If I want to do something, if I want to move my hand, I can do it. We don't really understand right now how that really works, and brain research is on a long way to find that out. But our experience says persons can make intentions and ideas into matter, into material structures. So, and this argument is, of course, the Kalam cosmological argument that has been developed by Bill Crate. And you can view a nice video, actually, on YouTube, if you have not seen that. I recommend that, watch that video. This is a strong argument, and of course, a lot of debate is going on about that. But basically, the question is, if there is a beginning to the universe, for what is it? Beginning argues for a transcendent cause beyond immanent factors. That's what I would conclude. And so this is a big argument for theism and against materialism and against pantheism. But our investigation went further, and in 98, in the last century, end of last century, we made a very interesting discovery that there is a vacuum energy in the universe that makes the universe expand faster and faster. And this energy must be fine-tuned to a very, very high accuracy, the highest accuracy that we know in the universe, 1 to 10 to the power of 60. So 59 zeros and then a 1. If you change the number of this vacuum energy density, which is a constant as far as we know today, then this vacuum energy density would not allow for the existence of stars and hence for the existence of life, which depends on stars, which create the elements and which create the energy necessary for life. So Lorentz Krauss says this is the most extreme fine-tuning problem that we know from physics. There are many more parameters. I don't want to go into the details. You can ask about this later, and you can read good books on that. And Fred Hoyle said a superintellect has monkeyed with physics when he looked at all these different details. And not only the universe as a whole, but the special system, Sun-Earth, is very much fit for life. The position within the galaxy, the sun with its parameters, mass, luminosity, energy flux, and so on, and the Earth, especially with magnetic field, with the moon, Jupiter plays an important role, many different points. We come to the conclusion that the universe exhibits exactly those properties that allow for the existence of intelligent observers. And of course, the universe must exhibit these properties, otherwise we would not be here. But of course, we are the consequence of this. We are not the cause for this. So the anthropic principle is a syllogism. It's not an explanation. The argument would go like this. A contingent system, contingent means something is as it is, but it could as well be just another way. It doesn't have to be that way, but it is just as it is. So a contingent system that could be could have different properties, which is composed of independent factors that work together as a system, and that yields together a purpose that is not inherent in the single components. This should be components, not composites. Yielding a purpose is intelligently caused. We often use this way of thinking. And when we look at the system, universe, earth, life, human beings, then we just must conclude this system is just such a system. It could be different. Many independent factors work together as a system. They connect to each other. And obviously, they work together in a very intricate, finely tuned way so that life can exist and that even intelligent life like us can exist. So this is a good argument that the universe could be intelligently caused. The materialistic explanation, the way around this, would be to increase probability. And to increase probability means to have more multiverses. To have more universes, it is multiverse, infinite. There's an infinite number of universes. But of course, there are many scientific questions to that and also philosophical questions to that. Because how can we observe other universes if they are not causally connected to our universe and just increase the probability if there is such a mechanism producing new universes all the time? And then this mechanism, if it produces all this, should be fine-tuned itself. And once you are within one of these universes, then you have a conditional probability only. Then the other universes don't help you anymore. You are within one universe, and then you need to look how probable is this that in one universe life can arise and exist. So there are still more arguments about that. There are large problems, and the main conclusion is this is just a metaphysical conclusion from a materialistic standpoint. Materialism is presupposed, and then your only solution to the fine-tuning is either big chance, big accident, or a multiverse. So I would say fine-tuning argues against pure chance, but it argues in favor of teleology, a guiding hand. Of course, a god could be that guiding hand, but in pantheism, you could argue, yeah, it could also be a principle. And so some philosophers even go in that direction and say, like Thomas Nagel, for example, and say, yeah, there is such a teleological principle. It's not a person, but it's a principle. But at least both have strong arguments against pure materialism, pure chance, that has no knowledge about the state that it wants to reach. And it's very probable that our state is reached. So, a long ride. Let's go to the last planet and finish. Life. What is the minimal number of genes? As far as we know, it's 250, or maybe it can be reduced by a few, let's say 200 genes are necessary to produce the necessary proteins for life to exist. And this only for parasites, if the nutrients are abundant. If you don't have the nutrients in the environment, then you need many more genes. So scientists have calculated the probability for the emergence of 250 genes by chance, and it's an astronomical number that is even larger. So everyone knows it can't just be chance. But there is more to it. There's the problem of biological information, genetic code. And you have all levels of information present in the genetic code. You have statistics, four nucleic acids, which are the letters, so to say. And then you have the syntax, how these letters can be combined in a three-letter code. And then you have the semantics, polymerases and other proteins translate the genetic code, the DNA and the RNA, into amino acids and build the proteins. And then you have the pragmatics, that the structure of the proteins that is encoded in the DNA leads to a certain kind of function that is crucial for life and to sustain life. It is similar to read a book and to ask someone, explain the structure of the ink on the paper of the book only on physical chemical laws, on the basis of physical chemical laws. This is an enterprise that can't be won, because you need intelligence and you need to know the information that is behind all that. So Rich Dawkins actually comes to the conclusion that biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. So the purpose and the design seem obvious, but he says it's only an illusion. It's only an appearance of it. It's not real. And Francis Crick also says biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved by purely material causes. So, is the appearance of design real, or is it deceiving us? I would say that coded information always points to an intelligent sender. At least that's our experience. Of course, it can't be a human sender in this kind, in this case, when we look to the basis of material life. And then I would also say life is more than just a force and more than just a material structure. Just think about a body that has just stopped to live. What is the difference in the structure of the body? Just the material structure is very much the same. So I would say life somehow, and some have argued about that, vis vitalis and so on, there must be some mysterious force that is life actually. But life somehow is more than just matter. And the Bible says that God somehow puts something special to matter in order that it can live. It's not just a conformation of certain material building blocks. So let's look at four different levels of complexity. Molecules form a cell. Cells form organs. Organs form tissues. Actually, the cells form tissues. Tissues form organs. And organs form organisms. Organisms form social groups. And on all these different levels, you find really interesting parallels to engineering, in my opinion. For example, a rather simple biological molecule is ATP synthase. This is the factory that produces the sandwiches in the cell, so energy that can be transported and used within the cell. It consists of only 8 to 20 protein subunits, but if you remove from these 8 protein subunits one unit, then it can't work anymore. It seems to be a fine-tuned cooperation. And just in parallel to a turbine, you also have a stator that is located in the cell membrane. You have a rotor that is rotating, and by the movement also fits together the ADP to ATP. The phosphate and the ATP are connected to the ATP, which means energy is stored in the ATP molecule and then can be transported to other places. And you have a medium that flows through it. It's really very analogous to a turbine that has been made by a human engineer. Even though turbines were produced before we saw the synthetase. So it seems there are principles of engineering that apply to both the cell and to our engineering as human beings. Very interesting. This is probably very famous. The irreducible complexity, of course, it's largely debated, and there are some pitfalls that have to be taken care of. But the question is, if you have a certain unit, a certain machine that fulfills a certain function, can you really remove everything from that machine without losing function? And I would say there are certain limits to machines, and you need some basic building blocks in order for a machine to function in the right way. And the question is whether random mutation and selection can really explain the existence of such irreducibly complex mechanisms or machines, or whether there is something more needed. And even in secular biology, this is disputed. For example, a German professor, he wrote a book, and he says the Darwinian principles of variation and selection can't explain the fact that from simple biological structures, complex biological systems could have developed. It is from simple forms of life more advanced. So the appearance of new organs, new functions, this cannot simply be explained by variation and selection. And he gives a lot of examples for that. Or even more famous, Thomas Nagel, that I have quoted before, it would be an advance if the secular theoretical establishment, he means the leading scientists, could wean itself off the materialism and Darwinism of the gaps. Very interesting formulation, by the way. This approach is incapable of providing an adequate account, either constitutive or historical, of our universe. So he's very critical of Darwinism and materialism and says there is something principally missing because of the fine-tuning of the universe and because our conscious minds that are self-conscious and that can recognize values, immaterial values and ideas and concepts and logic. I can't go into these details anymore. And then there's another interesting thing, convergence in nature. For example, did you ever wonder why a bumblebee can fly? Because if you calculate that, then you realize that the buoyancy force that lifts the bumblebee up with those little wings are much too small in order that a bumblebee can fly. And several people say this is a miracle. But what they didn't put into the calculations is that, like a colibri, the bumblebee not only is uplifted when the wings move down, but it's also uplifted when the wings move backwards, because they are rotating. They are rotating back and forth, and therefore there is a factor 2, and suddenly the bumblebee can fly. So it's very interesting. The bumblebee is not really related to the colibri in a very close way, even in an evolutionary picture. But they have developed the same mechanism how to fly, and a very intricate mechanism to fly. So the question is, does chance lead to the same results again and again? In our experience, we would doubt that probably. But convergence is universal in biology. For example, the eye, the camera eye, must have originated at least 20 times independently in the history of life. Like Professor Simon Conway Morris in Cambridge says in his book Life's Solution, you find repeatedly the same results in evolution. The vertebrates, the squids, spiders, annelids, and so on. So the eye appears again and again, independently, obviously. It's not inherited, but it develops again and again if we look back into the paleontological scale. So we have a conflict between chance on the molecular level, mutation, and teleology on the organismic level. And this is a very interesting challenge. At the same time, we hear sometimes the argument from bad design or atavisms is one example of bad design, which says, for example, that the so-called blinddarm, the appendix, in German it's the blind colon, so to say, that this is just a leftover without a function or with a bad function. And for a long time, people thought that the appendix is useless. But about 15 years ago, people found out by deeper research that it has a function, and it's kind of an education camp for immune cells, especially for the fetus and for young children. So there is a function. Of course, it's not a function that is necessary for us to live, but children that don't have the appendix anymore develop a worse immune system. So it's always difficult to argue against good design if you don't understand completely the function of something, because you might not know whether there is another function to that or deeper reasons why something is as it is, of course. But that's just a side view in mixed courses, because it's an argument that you often hear. Then there are, we come to the organismic level. Migrant birds, the East Siberian golden plover. It's just amazing. This bird knows how to fly from Alaska. And as the name says, East Siberian, it lives in West Alaska. And it flies in the winter times to Hawaii. There is no island on the way. There are 4,500 kilometers. And this bird flies in a nonstop flight to Hawaii. So the question is, how does he know that Hawaii is there anyway? How does he know to get there? And how does he know how much energy it needs to put on in order to have enough energy to arrive there? And energy is just enough to arrive there in a group flight, because they form a certain shape, a V shape. And if it flew alone without the colleagues, then it would not arrive in Hawaii. Yeah, so there is orientation on the magnetic field, and there is optimization of energy consumption. It's just amazing what we find in biology. It's just a few details that I wanted to show you because it's just so amazing. I would say that complexity with a purposeful function argues for intentionality. for intentional design, that someone wanted matter to be arranged in a certain way to arrive at certain ends. So let's conclude our journey, our hitchhiking through the universe. Of course, we could go on to other planets, but I want to leave it at that point. Time's up. We have seen we can understand nature, comprehensibility of nature. We have seen that the universe began to exist. There are good arguments for that, which means there is a transcendent beginning, probably. Then there is superhuman fine-tuning of the universe with regard to our existence. We are contingent with regard to the universe, but we are there anyway. Information is the foundation of life, and information usually is connected to an intelligent sender or constructor of the information. Then we have seen the enormous complexity even of simplest life, 250 genes, and we've seen that the building plans of organisms apply the same principles as engineers. So there are quite a few arguments, I would say, that really fit very well with the worldview of theism, that there is a personal creator. We don't know much about that creator just from looking at nature. We are dependent on his self-revelation if he's a person. You get to know a person by talking to the person, not by putting it into an experimental scientific device. At least I don't get to know my wife that way. I talk to her usually. I would say, as a theist, I don't need to be afraid of science, but I can enjoy science and exploring nature. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of nature, or of knowledge, as Proverbs says. And great are the works of the Lord. They are pondered by all who delight in them. This is actually the headline of the Cavendish Laboratories, as far as I know, in Cambridge. So what does methodological theism mean? It would mean understand God's ingenious creation theoretically and practically, examine it and deduce laws from that, expect function, purpose, and plan in it, and expect that you can solve riddles in nature. Maybe not all, because God's thoughts are higher, but he wants us to understand nature and to subdue it. Not to subdue it in order to exploit it, but also to conserve it, to better understand it, and to build our environment according to a good plan in harmony with nature. Then thinking God's thoughts after him, like Kepler did, knowing that he can use laws and create from nothing. But he can also always transcend his laws, of course. At the same time, as Christians, we know from the Bible that creation is not anymore as it actually was intended to be, however that happened. The Bible doesn't say much about that, but obviously there are consequences of the fall with regard to human nature and to the nature of the universe. So we should also expect destructive design if there is suffering after Genesis 3, obviously. And we are called to serve each other by alleviate consequences of the fall as well. So again, my encouragement, fear not, what the Bible say. The secular version is don't panic. I think they come to the same conclusion on different grounds. And I thank you for your patience. I rushed through 77 slides. The number is contingent, I would say.
Well, thank you very much, Alexander. Thank you for your great work of preparation, for the profound insights, and I think amazing examples from God's ingenious creation. I want to express again our appreciation for your love for God and for fulfilling the Great Commission in the academic realm. I continue to pray that the Lord will raise up a new generation of thinkers, Christian thinkers, who can win back the influence of the universities from a Christian worldview. Thank you so much, Alexander. Thank you all. May the Lord bless your families and your ministries as you serve and live for God. God bless
all.
Thank
you.